Hi, and welcome to the podcast. In today's podcast, we're going to be speaking to Renata, who is an executive coach, team coach, and facilitator. Renata has facilitated training and interventions on leadership development, team effectiveness, communication skills, and personal transformation for the past 18 years. She lectures globally in the Enneagram for Integrative Enneagram Solutions and specializes in Enneagram team coaching. She has trained over 900 coaches from 36 countries in how to use the Enneagram in team coaching. And that is actually where myself and Johnny met her this year in the team Enneagram coaching. And what an incredible training it was. So we have had this fantastic podcast off the back of that with Renata today. Johnny, what were your thoughts on it today?
I mean, it was absolutely wonderful to be able to get Renata onto the podcast today and to really find out more about how to use the Enneagram, which, for audience that don't know what the Enneagram is a kind of a powerful personality framework for understanding human behavior and motivation. But really kind of understanding its use with leaders, specifically also with teams, because that's what our training was all about, as you said. And also kind of like really kind of a deep dive into polarities and understanding polarities more, understanding the polarities of each type. And I was riveted throughout the whole podcast. I learned so much. So yeah, I took a lot from it.
I absolutely agree. It's a really fascinating conversation, and maybe we'll have, maybe if she'll be interested in having another conversation, because there was so much to talk about. We deep dived into what the impact of working with the Enneagram with teams is, the fact that it really increases empathy and psychological safety, and therefore really builds trust within teams, which, as we know, also feeds really deep levels of resilience as well, which again in this VUCA world is one of those things that's really, really needed. So this was a fantastic exploration of Enneagram. If you're interested in Enneagram at all, this is definitely the podcast to listen to. We speak to some of the elements of the Enneagram, and there is so much more to explore, the depth and nuance of the Enneagram. So I really hope you enjoy this podcast today. Hi, Renata. It's lovely to have you here on our podcast. And just like both myself and Johnny have met you really this year, and it's just so fantastic to have you here. I know, one of the things we're deeply interested in talking about is the Enneagram and all sorts of aspects around that. And I just want to frame that for our listeners who may be new to it. I'm wondering if you could give us a summary, if you like, of what the Enneagram is and what makes it a powerful framework for really understanding human behavior and motivation.
That's a big question, Emily. Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to see you both again. The Enneagram is, the most simple description would be a personality profiling system, but it's so much more than that. How it differs from other personality profiling systems like Myers-Briggs and others is that it's not so much about behavior as it is about what motivates that behavior. So it really works at a deep level. We can have three really driven, hardworking, successful, people who are really on top of their work. But what motivates or informs that behavior could be really different things. So, for one person, it could be a need to be liked or loved. Another person, it could be a need to have control. Another person, it could be a need to mitigate risk. So it's helpful in that it gets underneath the surface where we really understand what the core fears are and therefore the core avoidances. And there's a lot of complexity and nuance. So you can have people who are the same Enneagram type but show up in the world really differently depending on which of their centers of intelligence they prefer, which primal instinct is dominant in their profile, and which other types might also be strong in their profile. So it really is a rich tool for understanding ourselves and each other, which is why it's so helpful in team coaching. It has its roots in ancient wisdom, so it draws on many ancient wisdom traditions, And it is not just a static symbol. There's movement in the Enneagram, and the Enneagram describes how, if we're triggered or unresourceful, we're going to see movement in one direction. And that's why sometimes people sort of show up unexpectedly. You know, the people that we know, sometimes it's like, who the hell are you right now in this moment or today? You're not being yourself. You're behaving really differently. So we get a sense of what the movement is when we're resourceful and unresourceful, you know. So we're going to see some of the finer aspects of our personality come to the fore when we're doing well and we're resourced and we're growing and we're becoming more self-aware. And we're going to see some of the less fine aspects, when we're triggered. And so the Enneagram helps us understand kind of a range in which we operate and also understand the range that the people around us operate in. So it's really a map of showing our journey, you know. So that's why it's so useful in coaching, because it's not just pegging you into a hole and, you know, putting you in a box and that's who you are and that's how it is. And it also describes who we are for each type at our highest and our lowest in our evolution and our, you know, maturity. And we're all kind of bouncing around the levels a little bit, you know. But that's really useful as well to understand that, you know, any type is going to look very differently at a level of consciousness that is unaware, ego defended. As that person grows and evolves and becomes more self-aware, it's that type will show up really differently.
Renata, it's really interesting because the Enneagram, obviously, as you say, it's been around for some time. I remember kind of 30 years ago in kind of more kind of spiritual self-development circles, the Enneagram, I came across it then. But now, obviously, there seems to be this increasing in leadership, particularly, and as you say, in teams, the use of the Enneagram, both personally and also professionally. Why do you think that is right now that it's resonating so deeply now, particularly in leadership and with teams?
Johnny, I think it's exploding in its use in corporates globally. You know, the Integrative Enneagram report, which we use, which is an, you know, online questionnaire that types people very accurately and produces a really professional report, is going to be released in 30 languages because that's the demand. You know, it's currently in 16 languages, but it'll be out in 30 soon because globally, even in China, it's huge in China, you know.
Really? Wow, no idea.
It's huge in South America. It's huge in it's really exploding around the world in its use. It's sort of and increasingly organizations find it so useful for self-awareness, especially in leadership. Even I've had people from the Canadian Defence Force. They use it for their brigadiers and their generals. I mean, you can imagine people with the power like that really should have some awareness of what their triggers are and what their journey is. So I think, you know, ultimately, I think the more self-aware a leader is and the more they understand themselves and their triggers and their journey, the better they'll be as a leader. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of organizations globally now and big ones that we've heard of, especially, you know, I mean, of course, on the West Coast of the US, it's huge. So all the Silicon Valley, companies, you know, Google, Dropbox, et cetera, Facebook, even NASA, use the Enneagram throughout their organization, meaning every single person. You know, I've got a client in the States, 20,000 people, they all have an Enneagram report, so they can draw a report for the whole organization.
Wow, that's amazing. That
Yeah, well,
number, that's
they were
extraordinary.
10,000 and they were an Enneagram 3 company, and then they were bought out by another company, which is like a merger that was also 10,000 people, and now they're an Enneagram 8 company, and they can actually feel that shift in culture.
That's insane, isn't it? That's amazing. That's really incredible. And to that size as well, that's just extraordinary, isn't it? To bring it to see it working at that level.
Do you know,
And size of the company and so on.
it's so
Incredible.
interesting. As I was listening to you talk there, Renata, was this sense of like what might be happening to the system. So as an organization's gone from 10 and then it integrates, it's gone to 20 as the organization. But I suddenly thought, oh, I wonder what that's like, you know, globally. You're going from 16 to 30. I wonder what the shift is if there was a, you know, hypothetically, you know, what where the world is right now, if it was to do a global Enneagram. It'd be quite interesting.
That's national, you know, each nation doing an Enneagram maybe, or then as a globe as well.
There are theories about countries, you know,
Yeah, I'm sure. Yes,
being a student type. Yeah.
I loved what you were saying earlier. I think one of the things that really drew me to the Enneagram, or really resonated me with me when I did it some years ago, was like you say, the levels at which we work. You know, some days you turn up and you're kind of your bog standard self. You're kind of, bumbling along, and you're kind of somewhere in the middle there in terms of how you show up through your motivations and behaviors and so on, through your type and your subtype and so on. And then other times, maybe with more awareness, more reflectiveness, and so on, you're more in that kind of more in terms of your kind of a type. You're working at a kind of higher level, if you like. It's very hard to kind of make it into sort of higher and lower and so on. But and again, on a really bad day when there's less awareness, maybe when you're more triggered, maybe and so on, then there are other ways that you express yourself through your type. I'm really curious for again, it's so lovely to hear people's stories. What was your own experience of discovering the Enneagram when you did, and its polarities?
Polarity was kind of my first entry when I started coaching. So that was my frame of reference. So when I encountered the Enneagram, it was just clear to me that the Enneagram is a map of polarity. So really helpful for us to understand, the set of complementary opposites within ourselves, and really useful as a tool for doing the difficult work, which is the shadow work, becoming conscious of our shadows. You know, our egos like to acknowledge what's good and wonderful about us, and we often, when we meet the Enneagram, and certainly for me, once you get beyond just the rudimentary character descriptions, and you start to really see the shadow stuff, the response for many is horror. You know, to because you look at some of those things and you go like, I know that's true about me, but it's horrible. It's revolting. I don't want to be that, but I know I am, you know. And then the journey to be able to see those shadow aspects and hold them with great compassion, because, you know, really they're just misguided strategies that we devised at some point in our lives, very early on, to protect ourselves. You know, the whole Enneagram personality style is described by the Enneagram as a defense against our past. And so to be able to have compassion for the need to employ these strategies, you know, and to start to see through them. So when I see in myself that I'm still operating out of a perceived need to do certain things, out of my type, I just laugh. I'm sort of inwardly go like, really?
Yes.
Are you still doing that? Are you still finding it necessary? And it's like, well, there it is, you know. And I think, you know, the more you start to notice those things, the more you notice them. Yeah. But I think just what I see, and why I believe the Enneagram will continue to grow in its use in the world, you know, for individual growth and also for teams and organizations, is the healing that it facilitates between people when we can understand deeply. You know, I almost think that the work that I do with the Enneagram for individuals and teams, with teams, it's just I'm opening hearts, just opening hearts to each other, and it's a profound experience. And so when you take the Enneagram into organizations and teams, they sort of go, they might approach it initially as a once-off, you know, a little team build or something, and then it's like, wow, this is incredible. We want more of this, and they get a taste of the depth of it. But I just see over and over how even if you're just spending a day or two with a team, the awareness of each other's Enneagram types and where people are coming from shifts the relationships quite quickly. That awareness translates into a different way of being for teams. I've had a team after a day, the company phoned me the next week and they said, we don't know what you did with them, but they used to fight all the time and they don't now, And another team that had one half day session, not even, it's like it was a small team, and came back for a second session months later. And I said to them in the check-in, describe the team before our last session and describe the team now, just to get a gauge. And one guy whose first language wasn't English said, before last session, we fight at least 5 times a day. Now fight zero.
Isn't
And
that
so
interesting? Yeah. You know, Renata, we trained with you, Emily and I trained with you this year, and it was amazing when we were put into teams with people, some people we knew, some people we didn't know, and just experiencing the Enneagram and training in it for team coaching, but becoming a team. It was brilliant to be kind of as a coach put in that into a team, a new team that had been formed just for that, and to really kind of get an understanding of each other through the lens of the Enneagram as we were doing the training. And for me, that was so helpful because I kind of talking to the point you just spoke about there about the shift and the change. And for me, it was just like just sat in that team, and I've worked in many, many different teams, and I've never had that lens before of which to understand myself and to understand others, so that then we can work, we have a language that we can start using in terms of like how we relate to each other. And it was just eye-opening. And I mean, I know they call the Enneagram the shortcut to self-awareness, and it was definitely self-awareness, but also team awareness. So I really get that. It was great to have that experience of a team, and then also it was almost like teams of teams, because that where was about what four or five teams in the room, and it was kind of almost like how might we relate to the other teams, knowing their different types, the individuals and the types of the teams, and I just found it fascinating to experience it myself, so that then when we take it into organizations, I can really understand, what you're saying, the kind of impact that it can have.
Yeah. On the topic of polarities, I'm wondering if you can give, again, for our listeners particularly, an example of what that looks like. What is a polarity?
So each type within the core type is grappling with certain polarities. So there's a way that they make something good and right and something not, that they reject something. So, for example, Enneagram ones are interested in doing the good and the right thing and not the bad and the wrong thing. And they want to be good and right and not bad and wrong. And so there's a polarity there and many more within the Enneagram one. Enneagram two, for example, it's all about helping others, the considerate helper. So, what is good is I must help and I must give and I mustn't be selfish and receive. And so, and what we know is clearly in life, embracing both sides of the polarity is really where it's at. And so the Enneagram personality styles describe a way that we take a whole and we chop off one half and we reject one half. So for threes, I need to be successful and look good. And so failure and not looking good is not going to get me what I want in life. And so I can't be with failure, for example. For Enneagram fours, the deep subconscious belief is the only way I can be lovable is if I'm unique and special and different and have a certain identity, And so they reject ordinariness. But of course, we're all ordinary in a way, and we're all special in a way, right? So Enneagram fives have a deep need to understand, and so they reject not knowing. They have to know, and they go down these rabbit holes of researching things because, wisdom and understanding things is where it's at. They're very cerebral. They also are very protective of their inner resources because, I don't want to be depleted. I need to hold on to my energy. Enneagram sixes are fearful, and so they can't be with uncertainty and risk, which can be debilitating. For Enneagram sevens, they want pleasure and not pain. They want easy and not difficult. They don't want, they want freedom and not limitation or restriction. So you can see there's a set of polarities for each Enneagram. Eight is an active controller, so they're all about being strong and not weak, being powerful and not vulnerable. And so there's ways that that shows up in their behavior at work. They won't ask for help. They want to be independent, so they don't let other people know if they're not doing well. So and they also freak out if they don't have information from people, because that equals control. Enneagram nines are avoiding conflict and chaos. They just want peace and harmony, and you can understand how that becomes an Achilles heel as a leader, because they struggle to hold people accountable because that feels like conflict. And one of the principles with the Enneagram is the very, so the Enneagram is describing what each type is avoiding, but the very strategies we employ to avoid something sets into motion the conditions for that thing to occur. So for Enneagram nine, if I don't hold my direct account, a report accountable for not doing the work, then I'm avoiding that conflict, but the conflict doesn't go away. That just sets into motion conditions for me to have conflict with my boss or with a client, because the work's not done. So we're spending our life trying to strive for one thing and avoid the other half of the whole. And our journey to wholeness is to be able to embrace with equanimity both sides of that whole. So how, as a one, can I embrace the deep shadow part of me that is not good, that doesn't follow rules, that does, bad, in inverted commas, things, So in working with individuals in teams, the ability to hold the paradox or the polarity that an Enneagram one, they're ethical, they're detailed, they're structured. And that's a superpower for a team, is how they can bring structure and they can get into the detail and they can make sure that everything's right, all the T's are crossed, all the I's are dotted. And at the same time, they can be pedantic and anal and irritating with all that need for, no, we've got to stick to the rules, And then we've got types that are opposite that to that, like sevens, who are going to go, ugh. I had a team where the leader was a seven and everybody was ones, and at the end he said the session felt so structured, and the ones were like, with you as our leader, we felt like there was no structure. So it helps us understand the lens through which we see the world. And also, for those who find the one pedantic and too structured, can appreciate the polarity that sense of structure and detail and ethics and wanting to follow the rules deeply serves the team and deserves at the same time. And that individual can understand that there's a way that it serves and deserves. And then that is embracing that polarity. So I can take my irritation with the one who wants to, like, stick to the rules and go through every single detail, and go, actually, yes, that is a blessing in this team. Thank God we have somebody that does that. Even though at times it can be suffocating and slow the process down, because we can't make a decision because we need to consider every detail. And so with each Enneagram type, there's a way we can see how the gift that that type brings to the team and have a rich appreciation. So you get Enneagram eights who want to move to action really quickly, and then fives who are opposite to them, who want to slow down, do lots of thinking and preparation and data collection to make sure this is the right decision. Whereas the eights kind of just get a gut feel and want to go. Now, in a team, when they can understand that about each other, they can appreciate that that tension is necessary. The eights need to be slowed down by the fives because they've been burnt in their life, guaranteed, if they've been in leadership for a while, by acting too quickly without doing sufficient research. And the fives need somebody to light a fire under them, because they will research and analyze the data till the cows come home. So they need the eights to kind of go, we need to move. There's a point at which, yes, we could get more data, but we'll miss the boat if we don't take action. So suddenly they take traits in each other that have created tension and resentment, and they go, wow, actually, we see the necessity and the blessing in having this necessary tension. It's still going to irritate me naturally because as an if I'm an eight, I want to move quickly, and for, as a five, I feel horribly unprepared when they want to move to action so quickly. But we start to have an appreciation, you know, and also like I've had a team where they the revelation for one of the eights was saying to the five, so when you ask so many questions, it's not resistance. And the five goes, no, it's not resistance. I don't understand. That's why I ask lots of questions. And it was like, oh, I've always felt like when you ask questions, you're resisting. So can you see the instant healing that happens when people start to understand the motivation for the behavior? People think that Enneagram sixes are negative because they're constantly going, but what if? When we start to look at the team's history and say, how many times has that six saved us because of the you know, focus on risk, then it's like, oh, Jackie, keep asking all your questions, keep bringing your what ifs. You know, it's fine. We're going to be happy to have them now. So just understanding the motivation for people's behavior is profoundly healing in teams and in any relationship or system.
Yeah, and of course, I understand it can be used for relationships as well. Is that right, Renata?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, because and also we learned that a team has a type. Is that right?
Yes, Johnny. So that's actually a massively important aspect. So when we all have a little bit of all the nine types in us. And so that can be measured through a questionnaire and we can have a profile. So if you and Emily were the same type, but Emily had a very strong Enneagram one as her second type, and you had a very strong Enneagram four as your second type, then that flavors your type a little differently. So we take the profile of each of the team members and crunch that together such that the team has an Enneagram style, and that reveals the motivation of the system, potential issues of the system. So knowing the team type and what's strong in the team is transformational because then you can predict what kinds of issues will show up in that team system. And it's with a team Enneagram type, it's not like, oh, we've got, you know, seven Enneagram fives in this team, so we must be an Enneagram five team. You know, you can have a lot of people of a type, and the team style can be something different because everybody else in the team's got a lot of another number. So you can't easily predict the team style. But when you do, the report actually gives information, and I find what's so beautiful is I do an exercise where the team doesn't have to name the issues. The Enneagram names the issues. The Enneagram say, oh, well, if you're an Enneagram, you know, five team, here's a list of potential things that could happen. And then nobody has to name it. They just rank those statements, you know, on what is showing up. And very often that will name things or articulate things in a way that makes it really helpful for teams to go, that's what's happening in the system. So there is a description of the system, its values, how it handles relationships, decision making, tasks, you know, what that team will look like at their best and their worst. You know, so when the team's stressed, they can start to recognize that they're going to show up in a certain way and they're going to show up in a different way when they're doing well. And we can predict the types of dysfunctions that can be. And often, like, even if nobody's naming it, the report will name it and reveal what's happening in the system. And the report, we also can then understand because a leader has a lot of impact on a team. So if you know the leader's type and the leader's type in relation to the team type, that's helpful because sometimes you've got a lot of team members who are diametrically opposite to the leader's style. And that, you know, and we can't predict whether that's going to work well or not. It's all dependent on the level of integration or maturity or self-awareness of the leader.
Yeah, I was
But
going to ask about the leader actually, Renata, because the leader has quite a weighting in terms of the team report. Is that right? And if so, could you tell us why?
Because a leader just has more influence over, you know, the team norms and the way, the way the team operates. So, you know, the leader's information is weighted slightly more heavily than the rest of the team members, and that will influence the team style. But the team style is not necessarily what the leader's style is, and usually.
Yeah, I always found that very interesting, and the way you've described how the report actually comes about sharing coming to the team type is not what you think it is, and it's I think it's really well described. How do leaders kind of do you think with this awareness, how have you seen leaders kind of respond to this? I would say I'm hearing a good example there, but can you tell us of in terms of holding that as they start to get these insights? And they start to see these polarities as a team. How do you find, leaders hold that?
I think for the leader and the team, it's a revelation to have that revealed, and there's healing available. So I'll give you some examples. It also shows often leader bias. So we don't use the Enneagram for recruitment because that's not ethical. Any type can be a fantastic leader or accountant or salesperson or whatever. But with the leaders that I've worked with over years, I noticed that the ranks of their type over time increases. So, I've got a social two leader who leads with the heart center. And over the years, more and more social two feeling first people in his team. And he's not using the Enneagram, so there's just something that he recognizes in those people. I just worked with a team that whose leader is a self-pres five, and she has seven Enneagram fives in the team.
That's huge. That's
And that's
massive.
just through the she's interviewing people. There's no psychometric being used. There's no Enneagram being used. But she meets fives, and there's something in them that she recognizes. And they do really well in the domain of work that they do, this team they're in, scheduling in television. So, yeah, so I do notice that. But I've had an Enneagram 3 leader come into a team where there was a large contingent of Enneagram 9, and 9 and 3 are opposites in many ways. They're on a line. We haven't spoken about lines yet, but types on lines are opposites. So there's a whole, Pythagorean mathematical element to the Enneagram. And the self-pres 3 leader was sent into this team because the ship was sinking. They were a software development company, and they weren't producing the software fast enough. The CEO was a 9, the head of HR was a 9, and the head of software development was a 9. And so at a group level, they sent in an Enneagram 3, paid the 9 leader to stay for 2 years because of his organizational knowledge. And the first thing the Enneagram 3 person did, they're all about efficiency and results and making sure that you're, productive and get to the goal. He retrenched the testing team because the testing team obviously didn't have a lot to do if they weren't bringing the software out fast enough. And he could see that if they outsource testing, it would cost a fraction of the price. So the entire team, very strong in Enneagram 2, which are all about relationships, and Enneagram 9, all about people and harmony, were appalled and instantly hated this new Enneagram 3 leader. And on the first day of the session, just getting to grips with the different motivations and how the different types operate, Enneagram 3s, for the listeners who are not familiar with the Enneagram, are able to put feelings aside for the sake of, getting on with a job and achieving the goal. There was a moment where the Enneagram 9 leader had this epiphany in the session, and he said, "Oh my gosh, I've just realized that I could never have retrenched our people, anybody ever." He said, "And it was necessary, and I've just realized that retrenching the testing team was the kindest thing that could be done for the other 250 people that are in this organization." So, I've had an Enneagram 7 leader of an IT team. So the IT team's full of Enneagram 5s and 6s, these sort of quiet specialist technical people. And they're 5s and 6s, so there's a lot of anxiety in the team. And the 7 leader just goes, "Don't worry, it's going to be okay. And if it's not okay, then it's still okay." And he just calms the system down. But at the same time, in other teams, the Enneagram 7 leader will get feedback because 7s are really positive and optimistic. people will give them feedback like, we don't bring our problems to you anymore. We take them somewhere else, because you always just go, oh, don't worry, it's not so bad. It's going to be fine. You know, so it creates a real awareness for leaders of the impact that they have on their team. Social two leaders have so many of them, because I think two leaders like to do the Enneagram. You know, the realization of how they create dependence in their team, because they need to be needed. They want people to, and so their whole motivation is about being reliably available to people. But as they rise in the ranks, the number of people that they need to be reliably available increases, and they burn out chronically because they can't say no or put boundaries in place, or, you know, and so people do rely on them. And so that's this terrible catch-22 where they create so much dependence that people don't want to do anything without consulting them or running things by them. That eventually, you know, the wake-up call is, I can't do this. I have to say no. I have to put boundaries in place. And I have seen Enneagram 2 leaders burn out chronically. I just had a leader have a heart attack in his boardroom in front of his team. So,
Oh.
you know, the lesson is learned, and the Enneagram describes, I mean, the humility, which is the virtue of 2, is around recognizing the limitations of our body. She's part of the
Yeah.
lesson. So the Enneagram is really telling us what the things are that we need to wake up to and pay attention to. And, you know, so as a coaching tool, and for the leader to really understand, you know, where their growth is, and particularly what their impact is in the team.
It's really, I mean, I'm a social too, so I'm hearing a lot of what you're saying quite personally as well. And it's lovely hearing the way that you describe different teams, and it's not that there's any one perfect way of having Enneagram types within a team. There's not one kind of magic combination of ingredients of different types that make the perfect team. Each team is unique and different, and will be, it is what it is, and we can work with teams to help them to work out their best, and that's the way that it can improve. And like you said, with the Enneagram 3 coming in to create that huge change, sometimes it takes that input of something very different coming into the space to create change and shifts. But what I'm also loving what you're saying in how you're describing it is how it opens the heart, and how through exploring this, by understanding the different natures that are in the team that you have and the different motivations that people have, you build huge amounts of empathy. And potentially also really increase the psychological safety within an organization. I think, looking out there at the big world at the moment, psychological safety and empathy are the, two things that are really lacking in a lot of organizations, particularly where you get huge amounts of change. And that can really disrupt the psychological safety that people feel at work. And that can also then lead to a huge lack of empathy and understanding and so on. So I'm loving how you describe the Enneagram teamwork as really developing that empathy, developing that psychological safety for individuals and for the team as a whole in the organization. I suppose I'm really curious about what kinds of kind of embodied or experiential exercises do you find are most powerful or most impactful in bringing the Enneagram to life with teams.
Just before I speak about that, I just, as you were speaking, what came to mind is, you know, through the empathy and the psychological safety, teams will say in their fir on their first or second day with the Enneagram that I feel that the trust it is there. Like, I'm just feeling increasing levels of trust in this team.
Renato is so interesting. When I was in the team there, initially you kind of, I don't know, quite aware, and so I could feel the different forces at play, as it were, in the team to a degree, or what I thought were the different forces at play. And but by revealing and understanding each other more, suddenly I felt this kind of, yes, this more of a trust, more of a bond, more of a kind of letting our guards down. And kind of then with that being able to be much more open and understanding in our sharing. And so I literally that direct experience in just a short period of time, and it is fascinating. And I really hear you. And it must also speak to helping the team to be more resilient in kind of complex times, to deal with complexity, to deal with conflict, to deal with challenge. Certainly I felt that even in that small environment. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit to the kind of resilience aspect that the Enneagram can kind of help with and shed a light on.
So I think through the trust, first of all, it just makes it easier for people to give feedback. Because things become a known entity. People will speak about the Enneagram type and they'll own the fact that, oh, I'm a one and I really struggle to delegate. And now we understand that that's just not a flaw. It's because I need things to be done perfectly. And so it's hard to delegate, you know. For twos, it's hard for me to receive help and I don't ask for help. So then once the two said that, then I can go to the two in my team and say, hey, you know, you're not asking for help. We see you struggling. But you still insist on doing this all yourself, or whatever the case may be. You know, eights also don't ask for help. You know, we see you, Enneagram Seven, just fobbing off any concerns and risks, and just saying no, it's going to be fine. And we don't think that you're listening to the voices that are wanting to caution. We're not doing sufficient kind of checking of this thing. You know, we're about to make a bad decision. You know, Enneagram eights have a blind spot for just, you know, they think these larger than life personalities. They're like marshmallows wrapped in barbed wire. They've got these big warm hearts, but they can be really intimidating and overwhelming, and they have no idea that that's the impact that they're having on people. So when the Enneagram describes it and then they realize it, you know, a lot of eights in a debrief will go, I suppose I am, but I didn't realize. You know, when an eight thinks they're having a nice debate, the other person feels like they're being attacked. So when that becomes a known entity in the team, then it paves the way for me to say, whoa, Enneagram eight, I'm finding you quite scary now. That's a lot, you know.
Yes.
And we notice that the eights then start dialing it back through that awareness. So I think one of the ways it allows a team to be resilient is it opens up a whole new world of being able to name things and to give feedback and and to understand our blind spots, which is essential.
When I ran a tech business, I'm an SX7, and so great for tech and innovation. We won an award for innovation, kind of new ideas, vision, of course. But very interestingly, and to kind of make sure one was steering the ship, with detail and stuff, you can't always be innovating as a seven and shiny new things. And I found, and this was without the lens of the Enneagram, just listening to you talk just now, that I was aware of, having to move to what I didn't know. You've touched on briefly here about lines. We've got wings and lines, which I'd love you to talk to in a little bit more in a second, if that's okay, Renata. But what I found was, now what I know about lines, actually I was moving much more to I needed to be more detailed. I was moving more to a one and a five in terms of, I'm doing a little bit, well, particularly a one, actually, more details that were needed to put in place, more systems that were needed to be put in place in order to support the growth around the innovation. But it was uncomfortable. It took me more energy to stretch to those, but now I have a lens and I've been using it consistently since I took the Enneagram individually, and I've seen a complete change. In my office, we had books everywhere, right? Absolutely everywhere. I think, Emily, you can.
I can attest to the chaos, yeah.
There was chaos everywhere just because it was always new shiny things, etc., etc. And then I did the Enneagram, and I completely transformed my environment in here. Everything is put in its place. It's detailed. It's like completely what I wasn't as a default as a seven, but drawing on those lines really helped me. And of course, there's the wings. I was wondering if you could talk more about the lines and the wings now that I've just kind of spoken about it as a case study on myself.
Yeah, I love that. And well done. So one would need to look at the Enneagram diagram to notice that there's three geometrical shapes in the Enneagram diagram. There's a circle around it, which represents the law of one, which is about unity and wholeness, which is what our journey is towards. in ourselves and with each other. And then there is a triangle which represents the law of three, which is the law of creation. It's an arithmetical law. And then there is a hexad which represents the law of seven. And if you divide one by seven, and seven is the law of process, and we see it in the universe in octaves and music and the rainbow and chakras and 7 days of the week. There's a lot of things that correspond with the law of seven. If we divide one by seven, the lines on the Enneagram, so the Enneagram has 1 to 9, which the nine types around the circle. And then if you divide one by seven, you get 0.42, and basically follows the lines of the hexad that connect numbers by lines. And the types that your each type is connected, therefore, to two other types by lines. And the types on our lines are the two types most opposite to our core types, so the greatest polarity, and therefore represent the greatest opportunity for our integration. So the Enneagram is showing us that those opposite aspects are a necessary part of our growth. So I love your example, Johnny, because sevens are spontaneous, they want freedom, fun, they've got lots of ideas, they're very innovative, and they never like detail. But if they can learn to knuckle down on their line to one and get some structure, detail, discipline, then they instead of, if a seven's just left to be a seven, it's just going to be chaos and fun and freedom, no limitation and no structure. And of course, sevens become immensely powerful when they integrate their line to one and get disciplined and get into the detail and get some structure in their lives, and then that transforms. Then you see a seven that can actually activate those ideas, and put the structure in place to make them happen. And then the seven's also connected on the line to five. So the seven, that's all about freedom and fun and no avoiding pain and limitation, is connected to the two most sober, in inverted commas, types on the Enneagram. One and five are very serious and they go very deep. One is very deep into detail and structure, and five's very deep into knowledge and understanding and research. And so sevens, because they're moving from one thing to another very quickly, they tend to skim and get a superficial knowledge on things, and then they're on to the next thing. And the line to five draws them down to go and really spend time with one thing and get deep knowledge on something, and then they become a really incredible. And also, sevens are like running ragged, networking and socializing in the line to five. Fives are kind of introverts inside their castle walls, So it's a really healthy movement for fives to sevens to also be able to go into their castle walls, do some deep reflection, slow down, stop the chasing after shiny objects in the future and all that stuff, and be present with themselves. So each type is connected to two types that are opposite, and our journey is to really be able to incorporate the gifts of those types. That so the Enneagram's mapping and showing us what our greatest opportunity for integration and growth is. It really is a map of our journey. And we move on our lines all the time, so it's not a static symbol. So, when we're not doing well, we're going to see some of the more unhealthy aspects of our line types. And when we're resourced and growing and integrating and becoming more conscious, we're going to see evidence of, the person incorporating in them gifts of their line types. So, as I said, the lines connect us to the two types most opposite to our core type, and so they really represent a map of our journey towards integration. They show us what we most need to incorporate. It's a polarity for our own journey towards wholeness. It also represents the law of three because it's showing us two opposing forces that we're incorporating. And then we move on our lines. So when we're triggered and unresourceful, we're going to see evidence of some of the less healthy aspects of our line types. And when we're really doing well and we're, becoming more self-aware and we're growing, we're going to see evidence of some of the healthy gifts of the lion types being incorporated into our lives, just like your neat and tidy office is evidence of your integration on the line to one.
And if it was a triggered, what would that be on a one?
So sevens in Essex seven goes to Essex one. So it's a very particular kind of one. So if you were self-pres seven going to self-pres one, they're sort of gentle people, but Essex ones are fiery and they specialize in letting people know what's imperfect in them. Essex ones can become critical and judgmental. Yeah, and nitpicky.
I'm going
Yeah.
to go away and reflect on
That's fantastic.
that.
Just Renata, and I wish we had another hour. I mean, because there's so much to talk about around this. It's fantastic. It's so rich. And again, I'm struck so much by the richness of this as a way of understanding ourselves and integrating and understanding others as well. There's just so much depth and nuance to it. For those listening who would are curious maybe about starting their own Enneagram journey, where would you recommend that they begin?
So, sure, there are so many resources for people who are interested. There are many Enneagram schools. Nobody owns the Enneagram, so because it's ancient wisdom, nobody has copyright on it. So there are books, there are podcasts, there are courses, and there are different aspects of the Enneagram. I realize now, Emily, you asked me about somatic practices and I got sidetracked and didn't answer that part of the question. But there are, somatic schools, and so there are lots of different ones. The one that I would recommend, probably as an entry, is to do the level one training with Integrative Enneagram, only because that will give you access to a remarkably accurate and detailed Enneagram report, because it takes years to be trained to be able to type people through the narrative tradition, to be able to ask questions and type. And so if you want to be working with the Enneagram, especially if you're a coach or just an individual, that's a great way to start. For an individual, just go online and you can do the Integrative Enneagram questionnaire and just buy yourself a report for not too much money. But for practitioners wanting to incorporate the Enneagram into their coaching, or psychologists use Enneagram, anybody who's working with people in any way that's interested, I would recommend a level one training, preferably in person. They do offer it online and they offer it all over the world, and the schedule is out on the website for next year's trainings.
It's been such a rich conversation. We've talked about all things Enneagram. We've unpacked a little bit more also about the polarities as well, and really understanding those a little bit more. We've talked about how the Enneagram can really impact teams and open the hearts of people, really start to build that trust. I loved how you mentioned that trust. It can help to heal teams. It can increase empathy, improve psychological safety, and also by exploring some of the different aspects of the Enneagram, for example, the lines and so on, and the wings. We didn't even get to talk about much, but all of these other aspects of the lines, of the Enneagram types, we can start to then integrate and start to be really living at a very high and profound and integrated level. And this work with teams is so valuable. And I suppose request out to listeners, if you know of any teams who might benefit from this might be just the right thing to start to build trust and empathy and psychological safety and more resilience within the teams that you know. So Renata, it's been an absolute delight having you on the podcast, and maybe we'll have to continue this conversation in another podcast further down the line. But thank you so much for your time and energy and all that you've given us today.
Yeah, Renata, I'd love to say what I kept on hearing was, and it reminded me of what Dirk said, the founder behind IQ9, or when he talks about we're born with our kind of original song, and it's about returning to that song, and the journey to wholeness that you speak about, the healing of self and with others. Was, for me, it kind of really spoke to me there about that journey to wholeness.
Fantastic. Thank you
Thank
so
you
much.
both. It's been a real joy to see you and talk to you.
It's been a real pleasure, and as Emily said, my, you know, so much more to talk about. It's kind of a font of knowledge about the Enneagram. Is there anything you would like to kind of say as we wrap up, Renata, there at the end of this session? Anything else?
I just want to acknowledge you both for the contribution that you're making to the world with your podcast. What a wonderful thing. And it's been a great joy and pleasure to be part of it. So thank you for inviting me.
Well, fabulous. Thank you so much, Renata. We'll see you again soon.
Great. Thank you. Bye.